history friends, patrons, PhD pals all, to Poland is not yet lost, section D, part 1. There's just no real way to make this episode festive at all, so even though this episode is coming out on the 23rd of December, and it's our last episode of 2019, I'm afraid there's nothing really Christmassy, I have to say. So hopefully you're getting enough festivities from everything else you're doing, and you don't need me to indulge in that either, because trust me, I'll be indulging in plenty of festive cheer myself. I have to say a huge thanks to all of you who have made 2019 such a special place for When Diplomacy Fails, and for me professionally as well. I intend to make 2020 even better than 2019, which will be something of a feat considering that we're doing a PhD at the same time as doing this. But don't worry, I have seen some of you worry that I'm going to basically burn myself out in a nuclear fashion like I did already earlier this year, but that's not going to happen because I learned my lesson. Speaking of learning their lessons, the Polish Szlachta, or nobility, were certainly not learning their lessons, and it took them far too long, and arguably they learned these lessons too late, to save the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. That was a very forced segue, but it sets us up for what's to come in this episode. This is the final introductory episode of our series, so in 2 weeks' time we'll be starting off with a vengeance as we look at the opening royal election of 1698, which placed the Elector of Saxony, Augustus II, on the throne of Poland, for better or for worse. In this episode, our goal is to introduce you to a device which it is important for us to look at for two major reasons. The first is that if you didn't know it existed, you'd think the Liberum Veto was just an idea designed solely to foster disorder, and therefore it couldn't possibly have been recognised as a part of the Polish political process. We need to explain what it was, why it existed, and how the actual process of using the Liberum Veto worked to make the rest of what's to come in Poland Is Not Yet Lost clear. Second, and in line with this, the Liberum Veto is generally pointed to as having a wholly negative impact upon political proceedings in the Commonwealth in the 18th century. It paralysed legislation, cut off political debate, and prevented the Republic from properly organising itself. Here we'll assess the accuracy of these impressions. We need to base this podcast on solid ground, and therefore we need to understand something of the Liberum Veto up to the year 1700. Note that we're only going up to the year 1700 with this episode, and note that I said part 1 in the beginning. You see, much like we've done with section C introducing the Szlachta and the state, I intend to return to this issue once we're part of the way through the series, so that we can look back on subjects like the Polish nobility and the Liberum Veto with the first few decades of the 18th century in mind, and we can refocus our narrative to see where these troublesome topics fit into the looming decline of Poland. For the moment though, this episode here on the Liberum Veto is the last such introductory episode we'll be getting for roughly a year and a half, if my calculations are correct. So having said that, I'd like to say a huge thanks to you for listening to these episodes, if you in fact have done so. And if you haven't, and you intend to simply skip these episodes and listen to the episodes to come from episode 1, then like the Polish nobles back in the 18th century who invoked the Liberum Veto, I say to you, Nie pozwalam. I do not allow it. I'm just kidding, of course. Please feel free to listen to or not listen to whatever aspects of the series you see fit, and please feel free to let me know once I inevitably butcher the Polish pronunciation. I have been told that you guys appreciate me using the actual Polish terms, even though we might have some teething problems with pronunciation in the beginning. I do think it lends a certain authenticity to what we're doing here, and it at least helps you distinguish between the Szlachta of the Commonwealth and the nobility of the rest of Europe, so hopefully it's worthwhile doing so. Introductory episodes like these are purely designed to arm you with some context, so if you are ready to be armed, then fantastic, let's begin. Our last episode of 2019. For a non-Polish speaker, undertaking an examination of the Liberum Veto is like delving into a world populated by aliens. There were few occasions where I felt my lack of Polish more intimidating than when I tried to research this weighted political device. There is very good reason for why Polish historians over the 20th century set themselves the task of researching with a new vigour this fascinating but also tainted concept. Partly it was to bring out more of the history and context of the device, sort of like what we're trying to do now, but another aspect was almost certainly to assess to what extent the Liberum Veto could be blamed for what befell the Commonwealth in the 18th century. The veto is a key ingredient in the formula, which states that the Poles had only themselves to blame for what happened to their homeland, and it's not surprising to see Polish historians, from 1918 onwards, investigating this idea, especially considering what the 20th century was to bring for Polish nationalism and Poles in general. Perhaps they were trying to learn from their past. Perhaps, in the case of the fleeting exercise of actual independence from 1919 to 39, they were trying to get to grips with the flaws in their old government so that these flaws were not replicated in the new Second Republic. Perhaps, during the points when Poland was occupied by the Soviets, there was a genuine yearning to see whether it really was all of Poland's fault, and whether occupation was merely a symptom of her own native political malaise. Part of the mission of Pinyol, of Poland is Not Yet Lost, is to demonstrate that the Poles did not do it all to themselves, and that the removal of the Commonwealth from the map of Europe in 1795 would never have occurred in the first place had the unholy alliance of Prussia, Russia, and Austria not taken an enormous eraser to centuries of culture, tradition, and history in the name of their national expansion and interests. To those absolutist states who ruled over multi-ethnic peoples, the Commonwealth must have seemed like an aberration, and the Liberum Veto a key aspect of the unwieldiness of their political system. It was a political system that was naive, never truly united, and always only moments away from instability. Much like the idea of the selfish nobility throwing itself into the arms of the unholy alliance, the Liberum Veto as the silver bullet of death served the picture which the courts of Austria, Prussia, and Russia tried to paint remarkably well. Here, look, is another example of the Poles' political unsuitability, that they believed in their foolishness in a concept as impossible as unanimity in all matters. With such principles rooted in their political process, it's no wonder that the Commonwealth collapsed. And to prevent the spread of this disease of instability, it was only natural that the more naturally governed absolutist neighbours of Poland swooped in to fix the mess. From this, it's clear that even while few apologists today may be alive to claim that absolutism is the only true form of government, misconceptions about the Commonwealth still abound in the historical and political discourse. In a future episode examining the Liberum Veto in retrospect of the 18th century, we'll see for ourselves the bald fact that the Poles recognised on several occasions the need for reform. It was not the Poles, but those selfish neighbours of Poland who would not cease from intervening in Poland's political processes and maintaining the unsuitable political system that created in the Liberum Veto a kind of axe, which severed the limbs and then the head, at long last, of the Commonwealth. It is therefore possible to state that the Liberum Veto became a monster, but not all monsters are born as such. Much like the Commonwealth's other political innovations, which were later to become infamous, the Liberum Veto was incepted with the best of intentions, and only later on became a source of such dangerous unrest and paralysis. To answer the question of where this relationship with the Liberum Veto truly began, we must look to that watershed moment in Polish history, the Union of Lublin, in 1569. In his article examining the efforts made to reform the Liberum Veto in the 18th century, the historian Jerzy Lukowski noted that the Liberum Veto was deeply rooted in the very nature of the Polish-Lithuanian state. The 1569 Union of Lublin produced a geopolitical entity which contained competing as well as overlapping interests, and each state brought to the table its own noble traditions of participation in what then amounted to democracy, and of separate histories of friction and cooperation with their king and grand duke. We've seen this all before in the last episodes looking at the combination of the two Polish and Lithuanian states and how the nobilities in each of these states reacted to this combination. The extinction of the Jagiellonian dynasty in 1572 we also saw, and this was followed by the establishment of an extreme form of elective monarchy. No successor could be designated during a reigning incumbent's lifetime, all adult male nobles, the Schlachter, were entitled to participate personally in an election in which the choice was to be unanimous. Furthermore, all monarchs were subjected to elaborate safeguards designed to protect noble liberties against royal absolutism. Such measures contributed signally to the creation of a climate in which the nobility constantly suspected the ruler of machinations to extend his powers. As we've seen before, the suspicion of absolutism motivated much of the same's more restrictive legislation, which all aimed at curbing the power of the king. It created the closest thing at the time to democracy, but it also profoundly undermined the central authority and reduced significantly the efficiency of the Commonwealth from the beginning. The same was the Great Commons institution, which cleaved the different sections of ethnicities and nobilities, and which was supposed to ride these cross-currents, contradictions, and controversies. It alone could enact legislation, vote on taxation, or decide matters of war and peace. This meant, on the flip side, that if the same did not meet for whatever reason, these issues were ignored altogether. With the plethora of opinions, ethnicities, and traditions being rolled into the one body, grand pronouncements on the nobility holding the liberty and goodwill of the state in their hands could be made. The same was, at its core, however, not so much an all-powerful legislature as a forum for reconciling competing interests. The two missions went hand in hand, though, because by reconciling competing interests, individuals would be more likely to cooperate and thus ensure the fluid procession of a working government. Yet, reconciliation was taken to new heights thanks to the adoption of a certain principle which, to us, must appear bizarre: unanimity. At a time when other European states were imposing their will through absolutist institutions, it is strange indeed to see Poland go in the complete opposite direction and insist on the principle that nothing may be decided or agreed upon unless this agreement was unanimous. There was no middle ground, as Norman Davies noted, between a state of harmony and a state of total chaos. But how do we explain the emergence of such an uncompromising demand for total agreement? One idea puts it that because the same was the executive, and because that executive depended upon the voluntary participation of all the Szlachta in the country, any dissenting voice would mean that the legislation was very unlikely to be adhered to in that dissenting noble's lands. Ironically then, considering what it later became known for, the Liberum Veto was intended to guarantee a consensus at the top level, so that when it came time to implement said legislation, there would be no surprises, and no dissenting nobles could claim that they had objected to it all along. To this we can add that the same would not have had the power, even if it claimed the moral authority, to compel any nobles to do what they were told, and if the king got involved to try and do this, a crisis could develop and cause society to fragment into opposing camps. Better it was to use the same in the way it was intended, as a forum for settling and reconciling, since this would provide all legislation with a platform of accountability and cooperation from the beginning. Another idea puts it that because it was known that chaos could result from a slow or ineffective meeting of the same, men's minds would be focused on dealing with the legislation promptly, and even if they didn't agree with it, they would debate it responsibly as they were aware of what was at stake. A final argument, perhaps on the same level of the naivety scale, was the idea that institutions that are less than perfect were not worth keeping. By that I refer to the fact that, on paper, the concept of unanimity sounds ideal. Imagine the potential for productivity if everyone agrees on something. It seems that when drafting the Liberum Veto, its creators dwelt on this idea of the potential of the Liberum Veto rather than its practical implications. To them, there was no sense in aiming low in the constitutional sense and in searching merely for a majority, since a unanimous decision would provide the Commonwealth with the best means of crafting a stable and cooperative policy. A unanimous decision was to be the requirement. More than any other aspect of the Commonwealth's political life, the promise of unanimity is what's responsible for the Liberum Veto emerging. Unanimous decisions were of course impossible during royal elections, where the 50,000 or so Szlachta would never agree unanimously on a given candidate for king. Yet in the case of the same, where a few hundred nobles were involved instead, the concept of unanimity was rigorously and zealously adhered to and defended. Unanimity led to another concept as well, unique to Poland. It was the other end of the scale, the penalty, if you like, for failing to adhere to the concept of unanimity, and it would be implemented if a king failed to respect the privileges and rights of the szlachta. This was called a confederation. We've met this term before, but as a recap, it entitled the nobles of all types to instigate an armed rebellion against the king until such privileges were guaranteed and wrongs were righted. Confederations were distinct from rebellions because confederation was a collective pledge by the nobility to fight for what was right, whereas a rebellion was a revolt in support of things which were wrong. It said something about the wisdom of the nobility that they had appointed themselves in this position to tell the difference between right and wrong, but when a king felt the sting of a confederation, it is unlikely the distinction was all that important to him. Confederations, like the Liberum Veto, distinguished the Commonwealth from its European neighbours and caused a great deal of fascination and infamy when it was invoked. We imagine that in the Europe of absolutism, the appearance of nobles fighting for their rights and invoking the confederation was as though sanctioning a rebellion against the king and would have been met with admiration and awe in republics, thinking perhaps of the Dutch Republic and Venice, for instance, and utter scorn and horror in the likes of France, Spain, and even England. The Commonwealth played recklessly with the ideas of the divine right of kings. The only divine rights were those enshrined in the unwritten constitution of the Commonwealth, which guaranteed the nobility's privileges and safeguarded their interests above all. Confederations became more frequent just as the abuse of the Liberum Veto escalated in the troubled 18th century. 6 times were confederations issued in the 1700s, and each time they took another bit of legitimacy and shine off of the Commonwealth. Just as the Liberum Veto, of course, confederations as a principle were incepted with the best of intentions. This was to be the penalty for failing to adhere to the terms of unanimity and cooperation, which the Liberum Veto stipulated. It was a guarantee that unanimity would be respected, and it was thus a guarantee that this well-intentioned democracy would flourish. On 2 occasions in the 17th century, confederations were issued. The first was during the reign of Sigismund III, who had surrounded himself with Jesuit advisors and refused to respect the privileges of the nobles, even going so far as to get married without the same's permission, the naughty boy. In 1606, the nobles rose in revolt and issued a revealing rallying cry, which said a great deal about their deeply felt grievances. Their Act of Confederation in 1606, which held over 50,000 signatures, stated, "Our ancestors knew that they were born nobles rather than Catholics, that they were not descended from Levi, and that Poland is a political kingdom rather than a clerical one. They knew that the Holy Church is the guest of the states of this world, not their hereditary master, and they knew that what was due to the Lord and what was due to the country. They did not mix holy religion with politics, and did not submit either to priests or to gluttons." In the event, the king's armies fought against these confederates in a bloody civil war, an outcome which had never really been imagined when the concept of confederation had been incepted several hundred years before. Confederation, unlike the Liberum Veto, you see, was not invented during the Union of Lublin, but it had existed as an unwritten rule for several centuries. In the past, though, it had been applied when the state was in danger and the nobility was required to rally to defend it. On another occasion in 1573, the Confederation of Warsaw was created and all nobles joined in a bid to guarantee religious tolerance and freedoms. From this, and considering the high-minded aims of the Confederation that we just quoted from in 1606, it's hard to say that the idea of unanimity or confederations themselves were an inherently bad or foolish thing. Was not the freedom of religion a good thing? Was not the separation of church and state a good thing? Was not the rallying of all nobles to defend the state a good thing? Of course, these were all inherently good things, and as movements containing principles we can hopefully relate to, it singled the Poles out as incredibly forward-thinking for their time. Indeed, one of the problems with the likes of the Confederation or the Liberum Veto or the very concept of unanimity was that it was probably too forward-thinking for its own good. Not only was the Commonwealth not properly ready for the implications of such unanimity, but the negative repercussions of demanding such unanimity were never properly considered, since negative repercussions had, up to that point, that this principle was properly codified in 1573, never yet resulted from the concept of the nobles bandying together for the common well-being, as the label Commonwealth should suggest. In other words, the nobles of the Commonwealth had never really seen any negative fruits grow as a result of these high-minded pieces of legislation, but they were soon to see these fruits grow indeed. This all changed in the aforementioned 1606 Confederation, though, since the Confederates were defeated on the battlefield by other nobles, and Sigismund III had therefore beaten his objectors. There was nothing in the previous agreements which explained what to do in this situation, so Sigismund flew by the seat of his pants and issued a general amnesty. Not only this, but he also acquired a guarantee from the Szlachta that they would warn him 3 times of their intention to make a confederation before actually making one in the future again. Whether or not we sympathise with the actions of the nobles in this case, the results of it were clearly destructive. Having roused bloody murder and division among their peers and suffered no reprimands for their actions, it could be claimed that Sigismund would now be inclined to take them seriously, and a victory could be claimed as time elapsed and the memory of what had happened faded. It should be added that this exercise in guaranteeing unanimity came at the expense of the Commonwealth's security. Russia and Sweden, between 1606-09, when the Poles were fighting themselves, benefited immensely in the vacuum. This dangerous trend was repeated in the fatal confederation launched by Jerzy Lubomirski in the summer of 1667. During the Battle of Lake Gopto on the 13th of July 1667, Lubomirski's confederates destroyed some 2,000 nobles. Also on that field that day was the future king Jan Sobieski, who saw firsthand the terrible waste which the confederation created. Again, the confederation resulted in no real change being made. Nobody learned any lessons from Lubomirski's actions, and the only thing that that figure gained were the old lands which had been seized by the same in the preceding years, and which had originally moved him to rebel. Because of Lubomirski's misplaced concern for the king at the time, King John Casimir's absolutist schemes, as well as his resentment at losing his lands, this Polish magnate effectively destroyed the Commonwealth's ability to project any kind of central authority. Worse than the fact that Lubomirski's confederation dislocated royal power was the fact that the disgruntled nobleman offered nothing to serve in the vacuum this created. Kings of Poland were even more wary of confederations, were required to be even more legislatively cautious, were even more paranoid of another such civil war erupting, and they were provided with no powers nor granted no opportunities to make any reforms. Lubomirski blamed King John Casimir. The king blamed that disgruntled magnate, but both individuals would have disappeared within the year. A heartbroken king, John Casimir, would abdicate and withdraw to France, and Lubomirski would die in his restored estates in late 1668. So a storm had been created by this confederation in the late 1660s. This storm had destroyed everything, and nobody was left to clean up the mess or to prepare for other storms to come in the future. Just at the time as the confederations had cleaved the heart out of Polish cooperation, and the hetmans along the borderlands had turned west or east to pick a side and fight the needless fight, the Russians had surged forward into the gap provided by the civil war to seize Smolensk, Kiev, and the left bank of the Ukraine. The king was forced to sign these lands over in the Treaty of Andrusovo that year, and the same approved it because they were too preoccupied with their own internal conflicts and because they convinced themselves that the treaty was merely a tactical, temporary withdrawal. Kiev and Smolensk had been in the hands of the Muscovites before, so why not let them have it for a while we sort out our more important, civilized problems? But this was a different Russia to that which had been dealt with in the past, and the concessions of so much land to Moscow effectively levelled the playing field between Poland and Russia, so that the next time the two sides met in battle, the Russians possessed a preponderance of resources which they had not had before. Russia would not relinquish the Ukrainian lands, and for this reason Norman Davies assessed the impact of Jerzy Lubomirski's grievances to be the same as those of Bogdan Khmelnytsky, remember that Cossack hetman who started all these troubles in 1648. One was a Polish, supposedly patriotic noble, and one was an ambitious, supposedly merciless Cossack, yet both men shook the Commonwealth to its core during the middle of the 17th century, and by the time they had finished, Poland was never the same again. These examples of confederations established an unfortunate precedent for the 18th century, but it was while these disruptive tragedies were ongoing that the Liberum Veto was also undergoing some development. Rooted, as we learned, in the Union of Lublin and the admirable desire to achieve unanimous decisions and harmony in the legislative process, the veto, much like the concept of a confederation, caused no end of disruptions and chaos when the conflict was underway with Poland's neighbours, and when the kind of laborious legislative processes legally required by the Commonwealth slowed everything down. The Liberum Veto first appeared in 1580, when it was used to oppose the imposition of more taxes to support the war against Ivan the Terrible, but after that, the practice lapsed somewhat, as the legislative processes were, by and large, able to proceed smoothly. Then in 1652, something deeply unsettling and surprising happened. With everyone gathered together to approve a final bout of taxes to defeat Bogdan Khmelnytsky's revolt, the mood was one of tiredness and impatience to go home. At the moment when the time came to approve the taxes, one voice from the back of the same rang out from a Lithuanian Palatine. Nie podzwolam, I do not allow it. This was the tail end of a six-week session of the same, and everyone was exhausted from the concentrated debating, so the marshal of the same, the figure charged with controlling debate, did the traditional thing and called a break, and so the chamber emptied of its deputies. It had been a long day, so rather than stick around, everyone simply returned the next day. That had been the plan, at least, except by this point, some deputies had already begun to trickle home, perhaps suspecting, as was often the case, that the objecting voice had been dealt with behind the scenes. It was the Marshal of the Sejm's unenviable responsibility to arrive at unanimity, often by negotiating with objecting voices in the corridors or rooms of the Sejm, until a compromise was hammered out, and this compromise was often achieved behind closed doors. Armed with their assumptions that all had been sorted, the deputies began to trickle home in increasing numbers, and it was then that the marshal learned what had happened. While he had planned to find the Lithuanian objector the next morning, the individual had in fact left on a horse without telling a soul that night. He was long gone. Maybe, then, he didn't feel all that strongly about the objection after all, and maybe his dissenting voice could be ignored? Yet, the marshal discovered that the Lithuanian had presented a formal statement of veto with the Crown Secretariat. The implications were impossible to ignore. The Lithuanian had meant to object, and for whatever reason, he had left shortly thereafter, and now the Sejm was emptying by more people by the hour. Under these circumstances, there could be no unanimity, which meant that those desperately needed taxes for paying the armed forces and guaranteeing the war against the Cossacks would now not be available. When the Liberum Veto system worked, and when individuals were able to talk things through, the concept probably seemed like the most civilized, rational idea in the world to those assembled. On this occasion in 1652, though, when something as random or unpredictable as a magnate leaving in the middle of the night occurred, the entire legislative process of the Commonwealth was brought to a screeching halt. That Lithuanian could have been forced to return home by an urgent letter, or maybe he just returned home somewhat absent-mindedly and intended to return shortly after, but never did. It was human nature that sometimes odd or unexplainable behaviour should occur. Sometimes people do silly things they can't explain, and the Lithuanian's exit was likely one of those occasions. The reason for his leaving doesn't matter so much as the impact it had, and the implications it had for the future if such unexplainable things were to happen again. It highlighted a fact of the Commonwealth's legislative processes which was to become so painfully evident in the future. The country was, at the end of the day, utterly dependent upon the sensibilities of its participating nobles, behaving themselves and acting rationally. Such a dependence was in fact a dependence on so many variables that from the 1650s the Sejm's proceedings could never truly be based upon solid ground. Over the next 5 decades, it became increasingly obvious that relying on such a wide section of men was a recipe for disaster, especially when the use of the veto became not so much a device to ensure unanimity as had been intended, but a weapon to be used by the resentful to get what they want, or to block those that stood in their way. In the late 1660s, while Lubomirski's confederation destroyed the manhood of the Commonwealth and wrecked its security, the story in the Sejm was one of creeping disruption and chaos, as the veto was invoked in the middle of the session in 1666, and before the session even began in 1668, indicating in the latter case that some resentful nobleman had elected to torpedo proceedings until his grievances were met. This model of holding the Sejm hostage for the sake of your personal satisfaction and ignoring the legislative needs of the greater body politic seemed to become possible all at once, and this practice would take on a life of its own in the 18th century, as we'll see. What were the Poles to do in situations like these? In the late 17th century, when the veto was invoked with increasingly negative results, was there any remedy? Their carefully crafted laws, which had been designed to prevent absolutist tyranny and ensure unanimity, had never been considered ingredients of destruction, and few nobles were willing to admit that so well-intentioned a device as the veto should be done away with just because some among them chose to abuse it. Furthermore, some bizarre ideas were developed as a means of justifying the atmosphere which the use of reckless vetoing created. These ideas were captured by a book written by Andrei Fridrow. Fridrow had actually been the marshal in 1652, and he had been the guy running around like a headless chicken when he discovered that the dissenting Lithuanian had left the Sejm, and thus left them all in a serious legislative quandary. Incredibly, considering how bad this experience was, Fridrow emphasised his unshakable belief in the inherent goodness of the veto in a book called Literary Fragments, released in 1660, just before the worst abuses of the veto took place. Fridrow made the backwards argument that the veto was good precisely because it protected the minority of wise men from the stupidity of the majority, because it kept Poland poor, and thus it reduced the arrogance of the nobles, because these nobles were poor. These were ideas which were summarised in the Paradoxical Philosophy of Anarchy. And this idea is a bit of a mouthful, but it boiled down to the idea that chaos within a legislative process was a good thing, because no absolutists could emerge in a regime that possessed no firm support base. It is by unrule that Poland stands, was a roundabout way of saying that the order of the state was subordinated to the freedom of the people, in other words, the freedom of the nobility. The idea that personal liberty came first and should be valued above all was a core idea that governed all elements of Polish political discourse, and it is all the more remarkable because of how it anticipated current attitudes towards individual freedoms. We expect today to be placed before the aggrandizement of the states, or to have our rights valued before the right of the ruler to rule over is considered. Poland's lack of central authority in many respects follows logically from this belief, and while the lack of a powerful executive hindered much of Poland's political processes, a great deal of its tenets are with us today. Personal freedoms and the reduction in state controls over our lives are things that we take for granted now. Any time the state or government seeks to compel us to do anything, we immediately consider our rights. Of course, it could be said that 17th and 18th century kings and rulers had to adhere to a given code, normally one which harkened back to medieval times, such as Magna Carta. Yet it is to be appreciated that while Polish nobles were developing new ways and means to guard their rights or freedoms not too far away in France, Louis XIV was enforcing his uncompromising regime of absolutism over the French people. In modern times, Louis XIV's regime is to be scorned as overly restrictive and backward. So why are we so unwilling, or at least hesitant, to commend the Poles for the forward thinking inherent in their society? Is it because the Commonwealth was ultimately unsuccessful and it was picked apart by its neighbours? Well, so too was that of absolutist France, which fell into bloody pieces during the Revolution. Indeed, a major difference between the Commonwealth and France is that the Commonwealth was eaten alive by its neighbours, while the unsustainable absolutist regime in France was destroyed by its own disillusioned people. Does this not say something about the kind of society that the Commonwealth's agents sought to create, even if they were ultimately doomed to fail? Does it not say something about their ingenuity and progressiveness that ideas like religious freedom, political non-obligation, and personal liberty were so entrenched into the state as to make them part of the political process itself? We can, of course, scoff at any number of these devices. The freedom was a resource that was only available to the nobles, after all, and these well-intentioned political devices, basing themselves in the quest for unanimity, were ultimately doomed because they naively assumed that a weakened central authority would never be taken advantage of by more powerful neighbours. But isn't that partly what makes the Commonwealth example so inspiring, that its nobles were willing to take the risk of a bit of vulnerability in order to instill in their political culture a whole lot of freedom? After all, was it not Benjamin Franklin that said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that those who would give up liberty for the sake of security deserve neither and would lose both? In Poland's case, we can see that her nobles anticipated this idea from the very beginning. Whether we chalk it down to self-interest or to progressive forward-thinking, it must be said that Polish nobles sacrificed the security which absolutist obedience could bring, in the name of the unsure but profoundly more valuable ideas of liberty and representation. The veto was prone to abuse. The Confederation practice had the potential to wreak tragic havoc, and the search for unanimity among so many individuals may strike us as profoundly unrealistic. Yet this ideology was not sourced from some impossible idea. It was born in the values and principles which we hold to be true and essential today. Poles would rather sacrifice their state to the dustbin of history than live, petrified and silenced, under an absolutist king. And this is to be admired for its sheer audacity as much as its ideological innovation. Even at the very end, during the passage of the Constitution of 1793, which granted Poland the first written constitution of Europe, by the way, danger was known to be swirling all around the nobles that acted and voted in such provocative, to Poland's neighbours that is, legislation. That in 1793 it was judged to be worth it, whatever happened, is something we should take note of, and it was something which the defeated and stateless Poles took solace from as they considered their lack of nationhood in the decades to come. Their Commonwealth had been worth the struggle. Not only that, but while their neighbours had weighed in with all the cynical force and terror that an absolutist regime could muster, Republican Poland had not abandoned its principles even while such principles had cost it so dearly. All these nobles now had were these principles, as well as the memories of nationhood which would become still more faded as time progressed. It should therefore come as little surprise that Poland is not yet lost stood the test of time as a song and a slogan. It represented everything that Poland stood for, and it stated that powerful point that the principles and values of Poland could never die, just as surely as Polish nationhood itself would never vanish, so long as there remained those left to carry the message forward. In a few weeks' time, I hope to bring this process forward myself as we tackle the first proper episode of Poland Is Not Yet Lost, so I hope you'll join me then. Until then, though, my lovely history friends, patrons, PhD pals, and everyone else in between, my name is Zach, and this has been Section D, Part 1, looking at the Liberum Veto in Poland Is Not Yet Lost. You're the best. Thanks so much for a wonderful 2019, and I'll see you on the other side in 2020.